It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you have a kid in your life between the ages of 9 and 15, there's a pretty good chance you know who Rick Riordan is. He is the best-selling and incredibly prolific author of a number of series of books. His best-known centers around a kid named Percy Jackson, who is a demigod, a son of Poseidon. And Percy, spoiler alert, along with his demigod friends, saves the world. Riordan's latest series is inspired by Norse mythology, and the second book in the Magnus Chase and the Gods of Asgard series, The Hammer of Thor, has just been released. I talked with Riordan last week just before he spoke to a sold-out crowd of very excited readers at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. Rick Riordan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
My pleasure.
Now, I know you've told the story of the origin of the Percy Jackson books many, many times, but for those who may not be familiar, this was something that grew out of a request from your older son, right?
Right. When my son was about 7 years old, he was really struggling in school. He had just been diagnosed as ADHD and dyslexic. And about the only thing he liked in school was Greek mythology. So I began telling him bedtime stories at home based on the Greek myths. And when I ran out of the original myths, he asked me to make up a new one. And Percy Jackson came out of that. And next thing I know, I'm writing it down and it became a children's book.
You also were a teacher for many years. So when these books started to grow, were you also teaching middle school at the same time?
I taught for about 15 years, and while I was writing The Lightning Thief, yes, I was still a full-time teacher, and I definitely drew on my experience as a teacher, and I used my students as resources. When I had the manuscript, I asked some of my 6th, 7th, and 8th graders to read it for me first to make sure that it would fly with actual kids, because that's always the most important litmus test for me. And they helped me a lot. So yes, absolutely. I couldn't have written the books that I've written if not for my background as a teacher.
Well, I think one of the things that makes the Percy Jackson books so great is that your heroes are believable average kids. And now, obviously, you were connecting with your son because the characters in the Percy Jackson books, all of the demigods, are ADHD and dyslexic because they're demigods. But was that also part of your goal to make sure that these were kids, these were heroes that your students could relate to?
Yes. I mean, in my years in the classroom, I've taught all sorts of students. I mean, from fourth grade through high school and from every possible demographic you can imagine. And it's always been very important to me as a teacher and a writer that any child can pick up the books and find someone in there that looks and acts and thinks like they do, that they can relate to, that all kids have the opportunity to be a hero. So yes, representation is critical for me.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that because in the first series, the books that start with the Lightning Thief, there isn't a great deal of diversity as far as racial ethnic diversity. But the next series, there's a lot of diversity. There's an African American hero, a Chinese Canadian hero, a Latino, a Native American. Did you have a moment that made you think, I need to do more of this?
Yes, I mean, as I said, The Lightning Thief was a very personal book, and I didn't even know that I was going to be writing it down. It really was about representing learning differences and specifically representing my son. Once that series took off, I saw that I now had a platform that I could build upon and that I could use to expand the inclusivity of the characters in the series. And so, yes, that was very much a conscious choice that I realized that I needed to do more, that I had the opportunity to, and that I could potentially reach a great number of kids.
What kind of a response did you get to that change? Because I'm sure a lot of your readers didn't really notice it, but I'll bet some of them, it meant a lot to them.
Oh, absolutely. The letters that I've gotten, the emails, the comments on social media, the firsthand encounters that I've gotten with kids that have said, thank you so much. This, you don't know how much this meant to me. This got me through a really tough time. This is the first time that I've really felt like I have been seen in a popular work of fiction, and that I could see myself. It just means the world to me. To think that I can maybe reach out and say, hey, I do see you. You are not alone, and you are respected, and you're honored.
One of the characters that appeared in both of your Percy Jackson-based series, also later in the second series, we learn that he's gay. And I had an experience. My daughter is a big fan of the Percy Jackson books, and so are many, many of her friends. And one of her friends, in reading that section of the book, totally flipped out. And I happened to be around when she flipped out. And so we had a nice little conversation. And I have recently kind of returned to the subject with her and found that she's a lot more comfortable talking about it now. And I can imagine, I could almost feel the puppet strings, you orchestrating those kind of conversations. Did you imagine that happening?
Well, I think the best way to respond to something like that in a book is to generate a conversation. I mean, that is a teachable moment. As parents, we always should be looking for those moments and definitely not avoiding those moments. We should take them as opportunities to talk with our kids about what we believe and why we believe that and how the world is and all the different sorts of people that you're going to meet in the world. I've heard that a lot of conversations were generated. Obviously, there was some pushback in certain communities to the revelation that one of the characters was not heteronormative, but by and large, the response has been incredibly positive and incredibly affirming. And some of the best stories I've had, I had one reader who said, you know, I had really had a tough time with my own brother because he was making fun of some of my gay friends and just giving them a terrible time. But he, like me, was a big Percy Jackson fan. We both read it. And when he read that scene, we had a really good conversation about it. And he decided that maybe he shouldn't be bullying my friends and talking badly about them. And maybe, in fact, he wanted to meet them and sort of get to know them as people. And that's the kind of thing you can only hope for.
In your most recent series, the series that you are traveling right now promoting, the Magnus Chase series, this is inspired by Norse mythology, so we have all kinds of Vikings and a lot of really exciting things. Now, as a parent and as a coach who works with a lot of Muslim students, I was really excited to discover that there's a character in the book. She's a Valkyrie, but she's also Iraqi American, and she wears a hijab. And I'm thrilled about that. But it also, I can see that you've been working on diversifying. Was there another moment where you thought, this is a group of people in the United States right now that a lot of people are very wary of, and I want to bring them into this?
Yeah, the idea for a Muslima character is actually one that I've had for quite a while. Samira, the character you're speaking of, is based on one of my former students as well, as so many of these characters are. Right after 9/11 in 2001, I was teaching U.S. history when the news got into the classroom, and one of my students, a young Muslim girl, was the first one to break out into tears because she knew what this meant, not just for the United States, but for her family, for her faith, and that she, whether she liked it or not, had just been made an ambassador, thrust into the spotlight to try to convince people this was not what she was about, and this is not what her religion was about. And that's really stayed with me all these years. And her struggle and the struggle for so many kids like her that have to walk that line and have to be thrust into the spotlight unfairly. And I wanted to honor them. And Samira is one of the ways that I hope to do that.
Also, in the most recent book, The Hammer of Thor, there's also a transgender character. As you are broadening the horizons of your characters and increasing the diversity and making sure that kids can see themselves in these books, you know, a lot of parents don't read the books that their kids read. Have you gotten response from parents who are suddenly surprised to find that in these adventure stories, their kids are learning more than mythology?
Oh, sure. And not every parent is comfortable with that. But again, it goes back to, I think, the best response to that is not to try to shut it down or pretend that these issues don't exist or say, well, I don't want to talk to my child until they're 18, you know, and they're ready for this, because the world is not going to wait for us to be ready to talk about these issues. We have to be prepared to talk about them. And that can mean whatever it means for each family. But I would hope that it's seen as an opportunity to sit down with your kids and discuss these in the same way you would discuss any difficult issue. And in most cases, that is the response that I get.
Now, just in this brief conversation, we've covered 12 books. You're also concurrently publishing another series, The Trials of Apollo. You're an incredibly prolific writer. How do you do that? What's your schedule like?
I like to push myself. I'm happiest when I'm a little bit too busy. And I do also have a sense of wanting to strike while the iron is hot. I have a great, wonderful readership. I want to deliver the stories as long as I am happy writing them and enthusiastic about them, and I am, and as long as the readers continue to enjoy them, and it seems that they do, then I see no reason to slow down. I have way more ideas than I'll ever be able to write about, so I'll just get as many done as I can.
With the pace that you're setting in writing these novels, I mean, like I said, you've been extremely prolific. You've been going very fast, but the story arc of the series is long and intricate, and I haven't found any balls that you've dropped yet. How do you map this out so that you can remember all of these different threads?
Well, the readers will point out that there are little things I forget from time to time, and I do drop the ball occasionally, and they call me on it, and I fess up. I say, yeah, okay, I forgot that name, or I forgot that it was a Wednesday and not a Tuesday. But you know, the thing is, you can't be afraid of mistakes. I mean, I think that's true of just about everything about writing. If you're petrified by making a mistake, then you're never going to get the words out on the paper. I do map it out, literally. I do draw out a map of the different chapters. I go back and reread when necessary. And that's just how I try to keep things coherent. And of course, I have a great editor, and that certainly helps. And the copy editor is wonderful. She keeps a big Bible of the different names and things, so she can check me on that as well. So I have a lot of good help.
When do you like to write?
I am best in the morning, I have found. And again, every writer's different. My schedule really wouldn't work for maybe 9 out of 10 writers. Everybody has their own productive time. For me, it's around the edges of the day, in the morning and in the evening. And I also don't sit down and write for huge, long periods of time. I'm too ADHD, like Percy, like my son. I can't sit down from 9 to 5 and stare at a screen. So I'll write for 30 minutes, I'll get up, move around a little bit, sit down again, and just write in short bursts, and that seems to work for me.
Do you set deadlines, or do you just finish when you finish?
Oh, no, deadlines are critical. Deadlines are wonderful motivators. And especially with, as you said, the schedule that I've set for myself, really there isn't any leeway for me to sort of sit around and sit on a manuscript. I'm trying to produce a book every 6 months, and that's doable, but it is very tough. What I find is that's enough time for me to get it right, but it's not enough time for me to second guess myself. So it for me, works.
Now, in addition to trying to produce a book every 6 months, you have produced a lot of support materials as well, as the mom who's buying all of these things and very aware of all of the other things that you've also been putting out, including ebooks that combine the storylines from your Egyptian mythology novels and your Percy Jackson novels. So where does that come from? Are these stories that you can't get out of your head, or where do they come from?
A lot of the ancillary titles, like The Guide to the Norse Worlds or what have you, the stories, these are things that either, yes, they're smaller stories that didn't feel like full novels to me, but I still wanted to write them down. Or sometimes the publisher says, hey, you know, we'd really like to do a book about whatever it may be, about the Greek gods. Would you be willing to do a book like that? Sometimes I say no, but if I have time and I feel strongly about it and I think I could do a good job with it, I say yes.
You taught history and English. Was mythology something that you taught?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was invariably my students' favorite unit every time we did it. Sometimes I did Norse mythology, sometimes Greek and Roman, sometimes other mythologies from around the world. It's just a real high-interest topic. There is something about mythology. Those gods really are our first superheroes. And so I think there's something to be said for that as kind of a stage that kids go through, like the dinosaur stage. You know, there's the god stage, and they want to find out about the mythology and the monsters. And it just really speaks to kids, say, from age 8 to 14 and even beyond.
Was this something you were kind of obsessed with as a kid?
Mythology was my first gateway into reading, really. My eighth grade teacher was a wonderful teacher, and she got me into Norse mythology and into Greek and Roman mythology, and from there got me into writing my own stories. So she really was key into turning me into who I am today. As I tell people, you know, it only takes one really good teacher, and you hope that your children have that one teacher at some point in their lives.
So for you, the Norse mythology came before the Greek and Roman?
That's right. So going back to Magnus Chase is really like going home. It's coming full circle. It's writing at last about the mythology that got me interested in reading in general and in writing.
Of course, with the Greek and Roman mythology, that's something that a lot of people are familiar with, and it has shown up in fiction in a million different ways. The Norse mythology, though, has shown up in some very contemporary fiction in some very big and explosive ways with, of course, Thor and Marvel Comics and all of that. So treading into the same territory that Marvel is covering right now, did that give you any pause?
No, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Thor comic books. I grew up on those. I love them. But it's a very different take on the Norse mythology. It plays fast and loose with some of the myths. And even though I modernized them, I try to stay true to the bones of the story, the relationships between the characters, what happens in the myths, the descriptions. I try to stay very close to the primary sources in that. So I didn't really care about that. I just sort of tried to jettison the movies and the comic books from my mind and reinvent them the way I thought they would be.
And of course, your characters are very aware of popular culture, so they sort of slyly refer to those movies as well. So we know we're all on the same page.
That's right, yes. We're all aware of, you know, Tom Hiddleston and whatnot, but, you know, we're just sort of rolling our eyes in Rick Riordan's world and saying that is so not the way it is.
Now, I've been following a little bit on your blog. You've been doing some traveling and exploring Norse mythology at the root. Was that seem to, I don't know about your timeline, but it seemed to follow this writing rather than lead the writing. So why go now?
Well, this trip was really research for my third book in Magnus Chase. Yes, the first two are done. I still have one more, and Magnus is going to explore the ancient lands of the Vikings in the third book, so I figured I'd better get over there. And it's true, though, I often don't go to a place until after I've written about it. I never visited Italy or Greece until the entire Percy Jackson series was written. Of course, you don't really need to go there to know the myths and to appreciate them, but it certainly gives it a depth, a new resonance once you've been there.
So give me an example of how you found a new depth in one of those myths that not only had you loved and learned, but then turned into your own fiction.
Sure. When we visited the Acropolis in Athens a few years ago, some of the stories, some of the versions that the local Greeks told were very different than the versions I'd heard in anthologies translated into English. One of the most interesting little factoids was that snakes were a symbol of wisdom from the earth, because the birds were the symbol of the gods sending wisdom down from the heavens. But the other form of prophecy, the other big source of wisdom, came from Mother Earth, from Gaia, and they saw that as snakes creeping up from the ground. So I found that dichotomy really, really interesting, and it explained a lot about the monster Python, the great reptile who used to be in the Oracle of Delphi.
coming from the background you come from, when you were teaching, you were also writing novels for adults at the same time. You were writing mysteries. But Percy Jackson catapulted you to superstar status. I mean, we are right now backstage at a theater where the show sold out in less than 36 hours. And this is, of course, part of a mega book tour where I'm sure you're facing audiences like this all over the place. Now, of course, every writer dreams of that kind of success. What has it meant to you?
You know, I have two sons who do a very good job of keeping me from getting a big head. They see that as their job. They remind me that I'm just dad. I'm not all that much. Don't get a big head. Don't think you're so great. And also, the success was incremental. I mean, it's I suppose that's usually true. There's never really an overnight success. There's always a lot of laboring behind the scenes that people perhaps aren't aware of. There were a lot of years there that went into building that success. So it didn't feel like a shock. And I sort of only realized where I had gotten after I had been there for a while and could look back and say, wow, that's a lot of books. That's a lot of kids that I've talked to. So by the time I realized how big the books had gotten, I think I was a little more mentally prepared for it, but it still surprises me. I mean, I still go out into a theater like this and I worry that there won't be anybody there, because I remember having many book signings where there wasn't anybody there.
Well, I saw people lining up, so you're fine.
Okay,
you're fine tonight. Your first two Percy Jackson books have been turned into movies. And you wrote a letter that got widely circulated online to teachers and to your readers saying, really, don't waste your time watching these movies. Teachers, if you're thinking about showing these movies in your classes, please don't, because they're garbage and you could show better things. Now, so first of all, what was your involvement or lack of involvement with the movies?
Well, I don't think it was really very different than any other authors. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about Hollywood and how authors are involved with Hollywood. And by and large, 99.9% of the time, the author of the book has absolutely no control over what happens in the movie. It's done by committee, and the movie is a very different sort of beast than the novel. And I knew that. I went into that, you know, with that understanding, but I did find it a very frustrating process. And sometimes, you know, you're lucky. You get a director and a producer and a studio that really seem to get it, and they're in sync with what the author's sort of intending. And sometimes you don't. And mine was one of those times when they just sort of had a different vision, and I realized that very quickly. And I said, okay, well, you know, good luck. Bye. So I never saw the movies. I'm judging them based simply on the scripts that I read. And they're very different. I don't see that if you're going to do a unit on the books, the movies are going to do you much good. I mean, unless you want to do a pure contrast lesson. And even so, I think you could probably find 20 different ways to use classroom time better.
So you never watched them? You haven't even been curious?
No, I've never watched them. No, and I'm not curious at all. That's sort of like saying, aren't you curious to know how you're going to die? Well, not really. I mean, I know it's going to happen, but that doesn't mean I want to fast forward and see it.
Your characters get those kind of prophecies all the time.
Yes, they do. Usually they come out of it.
So do you see a future for your books on screen? I mean, you know, a lot of kids love to see their favorite books turned into movies.
I don't know. The Percy Jackson material is all tied up with Fox, who did the first two movies. So anything that has Percy and his world, anything that I do that even touches upon that world, is controlled by Fox. So I don't have any indication that they're going to do anything more than that. I'm not like chomping at the bit to see that. I mean, that was a pretty traumatic experience for me. As far as other series, I'm not too worried about it. If I get the perfect situation, then we'll see what happens.
Your letter that I mentioned really was directed toward teachers, but it also mentioned that you've shared a lot of the curriculum that you used in the classroom with teachers. Do you try to develop a relationship with teachers?
Usually online is where I try to do that. These days, it's more difficult for me to have one-on-one interactions. They're just so I have to be a little more protective of my time because of my writing schedule, and there's so many people that are interested in having that material. But I do try to make it available online. I am very cognizant of what teachers go through and how nice it is to have some good material out there that you can pull together quickly and use with your kids with success. So anytime I hear that a teacher's had luck with something that I created, I'm thrilled.
Given your bad experience with movies, I was a little bit surprised to see the announcement of the Rick Riordan imprint. So people will be publishing stories that are inspired by your stories. Rick Riordan presents these stories. Do you have concerns about turning your readers toward the creations of other people who are inspired by you? But these are people who, I mean, you're not going to have a lot of control over these creations.
Oh, no. It really isn't so much about me. Rick Riordan Presents is really about... So many kids ask me about other mythologies. When are you going to do Chinese mythology? When are you going to do a take on Aztec mythology and Indian mythology and so many different world mythologies? And they're all wonderful. But I don't really feel like perhaps I'm the person to write those books. My background is not in Aztec mythology. It's not where I'm from. It's not my milieu, and so it would be better, I think, to find a writer who's interested in it and has a take on it that they want to produce that I feel would be good for middle school kids, and let them do it and have me be a cheerleader for them and say, this is a great book, you guys need to read it. Whether it reads like a Rick Riordan book, I don't care at all. I mean, I don't want it to be just sort of Percy Jackson, you know, the Chinese version. I want the author to have complete control, as they would if they were shopping it to any publisher. It's just, I hope, a vehicle to bring attention to other writers that have not been as represented and not been as supported in the publishing industry, and give them a place that's a launch pad for them.
What's the timeline for that? Do you already have books that you have approved?
We are just shopping around for proposals now. We've gotten some interesting proposals. We're hoping to announce the titles in 2017 and publish the first two in 2018. So, you know, when it's ready, it'll be ready. We're not going to rush it.
One of the things that I know your readers love and I love about your books is that although the series stand on their own, the worlds touch. We see characters or glimpses of characters or hear about characters. There are all of these little intertwining storylines. And as I mentioned earlier, there are many different stories that are popping out in ebooks and support materials and things like that. Do you think about your characters a lot? Are they alive in there?
Yes, absolutely. They're all real characters. I feel like I know them. I feel like they're former students of mine that I see from time to time and say, hey, how you doing? So yes, they're always popping around in there, and I can easily capture their voices and think about how they would respond to certain things.
Well, Rick Riordan, I know the Vikings are waiting, but thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.